of her blood-guard Valkyrie. Valdir and his world-breakers slam their heads together. I close my eyes, praying for it to end, knowing it isn't real. Am I real? Am I real? The darkness seeks to swallow me. Witness! It rumbles to me in Osgard's voice. Terrified, I open my eyes, squinting into the maelstrom of wind.
Nyarlathotha, sin tir richa,
Osgard shouts. The obsidians echo him. He points at Sefi and Valdir and flails his face, summoning the demon from the queen and her mate.
Hygla Ragna,
they scream, and the queen of the Valkyrie and Valdir the Unshorn run forward, two dark blades cutting through the light of the moon. Their acolytes follow in a blue and grey tide, jumping out the back of the ship in tight, beautiful martial lines that'd make any grey proud. The assault shuttles follow. Boots over the edge of the ship door, Osgard laughs uncontrollably, possessed, as if this were all his making, and he were a god, overjoyed with the fidelity of his children. He points to me and reels my soul toward him. I clutch my terrible rifle tight and abandon my safety. As his arms wrap around me where the floor ends, I feel my terror flee and the evil in him disappears. My jacket whips in the wind, my pants are pierced with freezing air, but I feel nothing but warmth and love and acceptance from his laughter and from his naked body as we stand together overlooking the face of a living world.
See! He roars. See! Do you see with your spirit eyes?
Mars is captured in twilight. Her two moons watch us on the horizon. Beneath our metal feet is a great white shield mountain of northern Cimmeria. It seems the head of a giant standing with his feet warmed by the molten core of his world. The city of Nike sweeps from his northwest shoulder toward the sea like a cape of stardust. Explosions flash in the city near its spaceport. Across the landscape, lumps of metal lit by lights hunch in the gloom like little lonely goblins. Mines. They spit no fire. Only their warning sirens flicker, staining the ground red. Their sky guns are down. It's working. Triumph swells in me. The Skugi did it. Freyhild lowered the defense grid, that beautiful maniac. It's working. I'm not going to be executed. Ore freighters on the horizon drop assault shuttles and airborne obsidian over the winter landscape, over the shield mountain, and along the plains, spitting Sefi's children down on the mines, my plan and the Skugi prepared for them. The Republic defense fleet won't be able to react. Quicksilver's missiles streak up out of the mountains from hidden installations, but all tribe rip wings swing down to silence them. All the colors dance in a wild, vivid frenzy. The ground, the sky, the ships, the mines, the air itself are alive with spiritual fire. This is the domain of the obsidian, a world within an unseen world. Beneath the hallucination, I feel the beauty and inevitability of this day. For 10 years, the obsidians were to the Republic as Volga was to me, doggedly carrying the weight of all the rest, only to be denied the fruits of their labor. Fight, the little one said to them. Kill for us, Valdir. Leave your homeland, but have none of our land, Sefi. Don't shop in our stores, Volga. Don't stand too tall, Volga, because we are afraid of you. Well, a pox on hypocrites one and all. They had their chance, and now the Queen of the Valkyrie has come for their helium mines. I find myself proud of them as I laugh with the mad shaman, because in all this stupid, greedy world, the spirit comes alive when you see someone say, no more.
Do you see?
Osgard shouts beside me with tears in his eyes. His face is like that of a child, not a monster.
We have come home. Do you see? This is our Volkland.
Yes, I proclaim, pumping my dread rifle in the air. Yes, he pushes me back and says he must join. Yes, I shout, we must. He bellows at me, and only after I jump off the edge of the transport ramp do I realize he bellowed at me to stay, that I wear no armor. But I do not care, because the gods protect me. He has seen my fate in the firebones, and I do not die here from the missiles that streak past me. I do not die from the railgun rounds that tear apart the sky. I fly toward a pack of falling Valkyrie, screaming for the glory of the Obsidian people and all their justified vengeance. I fall in amongst them. Armored women and men look at me. They gesture with eyes wide through bone helmets. They are laughing. Onward, Valkyrie, I scream as wind pulls my lips back from my teeth. My grav boots accelerate with a twist of my toes, and I dive toward the vanguard, streaking past Sephi and Valdir, filled with righteous glory, as I tear toward the burning mouth of an open mine, unscathed through tongues of fire, and pierce the crust of the world to land amongst towering behemoths of metal. They turn their glowing evil red eyes toward me, and I laugh when they do not fire, for I am a spirit warrior, and I point my rifle at them, pull the trigger and shit down my leg, because I am alone amongst a pack of hunter-killer robots, and it is no rifle in my hand. It is only a mop. Then Sephi and Valdir land, and the world goes mad.
Part 3. Treason. During war, the laws are silent. Quintus Tullius Cicero. Chapter 42. Lysander. A chorus upon the pale. I run through the water I stole from Ajax's assassins in 2 days. Though heat stroke is unlikely due to my physiology, dehydration plagues me and obscures even the most basic mental and motor functions. Though my eye was not blinded by the firebrand due to avoiding its core flare, my vision is dreadfully impaired. 3 times I nearly lose my way when the features of the desert mislead me and I lose sight of the mountains. But I keep as straight a path north as I can, knowing I must eventually run into Erebos if I stay along the mountains. I could not accept Apollonius's help, but I might find some unaffiliated aid in Erebos. If I recover enough, I can decide how to reach Atalantia without chancing Ajax's interference. I eat the meat of cacti and suck the water from desert lotus, but I feel myself fading. I find myself wishing I were back on the Archie, listening to Cassius and Pytha bicker as I lie reading in my bunk. I wish Kalindora were with me, that she hadn't assumed I died. I wish Seraphina had simply stepped to the right. Only my anger at the desert itself keeps me going. Everything seems like a bleached mirage now. The sun is a malevolent fat troll that squats over the desert, burning any uncovered skin in 15 minutes and punishing me when I dare walk in the day. I sweat and sleep when I can find shade, and walk through the mornings when the plier is barren of grace. On my 4th day, I find the rotting carcass of a glass leviathan somehow swept in from the sea. The translucent flesh of the giant sea creature writhes with clouds of predatory blood flies and a wake of buzzards thick enough to blot out the sky. I steer well around it. When the northern storm sweeps rain showers over the desert, I lie down in joy to let it soothe my mangled face and the razor cuts Seneca and his men opened on my thighs and hip. Mercury is a lovely planet, with temperate coasts and mountain hotels, and hot springs and cool valleys and coral seas. But to have all that, it had to have the hell of the Ladan around its equator. I curse the bastards that terraformed this planet. I curse the rocks. I curse the sun, the sand, myself, for needing so much gory damn water. And I curse Ajax. But more so, I curse the culture that let him grow wicked. The peerless scar was formalized by Selenius to mark a gold worthy of respect, not worship. Our rigorous institutes were built to educate us to be shepherds, not cannibals. The world provided Darrow to show us how far we'd lost our way. To fight him, we did not find our path again. We strayed further and further, learning all the wrong lessons. Gradually, the desert gives way to a semi-arid climate as I make my way to more northern latitudes. The transition is subtle, barely noticeable at first, but even the smallest signs of life give me hope. Torrential rain has eroded hillsides, but also seduced weeds and flowers to spring out of the rocky soil. My vision returns enough in my right eye to see green interspersed with brown. The ground is still unforgiving and Spartan, but the worst danger is over. Where there is water, anyone can survive. Dealing with spiraling black antlers and birds shaped like fairies, feed off the orange berries of gnarled geranium shrubs, only to zip home to their hive castles amidst cacti the size of houses. While I haven't the strength to hunt either with my razor, I eat as many berries as I can find among the thistles, never minding the cramps the excess fiber causes in my belly. I eat grubs from underneath boulders and swallow the yolks of bird eggs I find in low shrubs. Tubers and roots make the bulk of my diet, which causes more cramps, until I find a sulphur viper basking in the sun beneath a dead olive tree. I crush its head with a rock and drink its blood, knowing my immune system will likely handle the pathogens it carries. The mild nausea is well worth the valuable vitamins. When I've drained it, I roast its meter-long body over a fire. Its meat is tough and elastic, like langsat flesh, but the calories give me fresh optimism as I make my push toward Erebus. Pausing on a ridgeline that leads to a fertile valley, I look back at the desert one last time. It waits there in the distance, patient, eternal, the graveyard of armies, but not me. I turn my back on it, but carry its lessons with me. The next kilometers are almost pleasant. While the temperature hovers around 50 degrees Celsius in the morning, frequent showers from the roiling clouds keep me cool and soothe the agony of my burn. Birds twitter in orderly citrus groves, which I eat heavily from as I pass. Following the tracks of an abandoned combine, I find a shed and a small farmhouse that looks to have been abandoned in haste. It has been looted at least once, and I'm unable to find medical supplies. But in the garden, I find an aloe plant, which I'm able to distill into a paste for my burn. It takes the sharp edge off the itching sting, but does little for the deep nerve trauma, and nothing at all for my eye, which throbs down to the very root of the ocular nerve. The power is out in the farm, but it is nice having a puzzle to solve that doesn't include imminent death. In a few hours, I'm able to rig the solar panels of the combine to work with the stove, on which I cook dry-pressed curry from a fresh can. I also manage to power the ancient HC in the living room. The HC won't link with the holonet, and instead shows only a society emergency broadcast message giving instructions for all citizens to evacuate Erebus and the surrounding lands for Naran, 100 kilometers northeast. I think of the tight showers on the Archi as I draw myself a bath. I slip into the cold water and shudder. It is the most pleasant thing I've experienced since the Calderium with Cassius. My legs are too long for the tub and splay out awkwardly against the fraying wallpaper. It's only then I realize how much weight I've lost. 20 kilos, maybe? My body looks like it belongs to a rust lung victim. It is emaciated, any skin exposed to the sun, swollen and peeling. I doze lightly in the bath for hours. After drinking another liter of water, I collapse onto the former fab bed and sleep for an entire day. I set back out 2 mornings after arriving at the farm. I have changed the tattered pulse armor underlining for the farmer's clothing. I look ludicrous, the sleeves barely coming to my elbows and the pants to my shins. I look back at the farm, sorry to leave it, and wonder for a moment if I shouldn't just stay there. What am I rushing back to? A future as Atalantia's rival? A duel with Ajax when he must face what he has done? A short life of politics and betrayal? Revenge, which I don't want, even after Darrow took half my face? To be with my people? Why? Gold has grown sicker in my absence. But even knowing all that, there is still an undeniable itch to return, as if my spirit were drawn by gravity. I need to realize the promise I made to Dido, the excuse I gave to Cassius when I betrayed him. I must unite gold. More than that, I must change it. That is what makes me leave the farmhouse behind. That and the understanding that I must help liberate Kalindora, Rhone, and the Praetorians from Heliopolis. It would be immoral not to help those who risked all for me. By the good repair of Seneca's gear, it seems the Ash Legions weren't broken entirely. An invasion will be coming for Heliopolis, one I doubt my friends will survive. The walk to Erebos is leisurely compared with the desert. I cut through groves of wild cypress and orchards redolent with the smell of starheart blossoms. At times I see hovercraft on the horizon, or the occasional society patrol in the lower atmosphere. Though black clouds brood to the north, the worst of the storm seems to have passed. I pace myself, stopping frequently to gorge on the food I foraged from the farmhouse and the pack of tangerines pulled from the trees. My route takes me parallel to the Via Gloria, the white, frictionless highway that connects the cities that border the Ladan by land. It is broken by bombardment and littered with blackened Republic assault vehicles and desiccated corpses. I sleep under a grapefruit tree, and the next morning come across a family of sun-baked red natives walking along a country road, pushing a cart full of their life's belongings. They watch me approach with unease. I greet them politely and comment on the weather, as Mercurians always do. They look at each other, then up, and up at me and my melted face, and then they bow.
"Odd weather, yes, Dominus," the man says quietly.
"Devil weather," the woman says, with a little more heat, much to her man's distress.
"Greedy Martian, thought he could break our spirit."
"Not this spirit, Dominus," the woman says. "A little weather won't tame us." "Darrow, you mean?"
"Don't even give him a name, Dominus," she says bitterly. "His men ransacked our employer's latifundia, took him away, saying he harboured the Fear Knight. Vale, bless the man. Did it all with smiles, of course. But when they were done, what have we got left? Just what they left us. We work for our share. We don't take the pity of Martian marauders." She spits. "Latifundia went to bits. Our head talk started running the place, but no one ever came for the hall. It's just sitting out there rotting."
"You with the legions?" she asks. "You look like you've seen Hades itself, Dominus." I scan the road behind her. "Only its gatekeepers."
"If there's anything you desire..."
Her eyes dart to my burned face, and she waves to her cart, again to her husband's distress. They barely have enough for themselves. "Just information. Have you seen any society forces?" I ask.
"Fear Knight's men were through here not too long ago, Dominus. Never know where you can find them, though. Like veiled spirits they are. Rest of the legions are out to the east, last I heard. A bastion set down. Here there be ash legions in Naran. It's flooding with refugees from Tyche and the coast. Poor souls. Whole city's gone. We're heading east to the riverlands. Here they're hiring folk out there for the clean-up."
"There's no legions in Erebos," I say in confusion.
Erebos? It's drowned, Dominus, the man says.
I frown. The waves couldn't have come this far.
What do you mean, drowned?
By late morning I summit a hill that looks down into the valley of Erebos and see for myself. Erebos was a proud library city once, a serene and bucolic vanity created as a gift for my grandmother by the master maker Glerastes. The high city, all in thrall to the great library, was hewn from the back of a low mountain just beneath a great dam. The dam protected the city from seasonal floods caused by the melting of mountain snow, a quick affair under Mercury's sun. When I saw it as a child at Glerastes' side, I deemed it a giant turtle with a vine-wrapped city upon its back. He grumbled that it was a tortoise representing the patience and inevitable victory of knowledge. Now it is a watery necropolis. The great dam has broken, the pulse fields likely failing during the storm. The rush of water left a path of destruction across the city so thorough it would be a wonder if anyone survived. Carrion birds rule here now. There are no medical teams from either army, only bands of refugees across the flooded valley and plains beyond, trundling north in lines by the thousands. I sit down, finally feeling the exhaustion of the last week in my bones. Darrow has broken the planet. A sense of futility rises in me. What could anyone do to fix this? Resolving to refill my water and connect with one of the refugee trains, I stumble down the foothills, passing through forests entirely scalped by the wind. Not a tree stands. I wade through fields of lavender where bees still pollinate and draw to a halt. At the foot of the Via Gloria, a peculiar arrangement sprawls around the Arch of Octavia, which leads into the city. Even with my blurry vision, I know what it is. I walk down the hill. There beside the great archway, I find a scene of horror. Amongst a sea of lavender, the remains of more than 400 humans hang upon metal poles, blistering and naked, but for the wake of buzzards that clothe them in feathers of yellow and scarlet. The poles that puncture the humans are as thick as my wrists, sharp at the point and tapered. Each has been driven into the anal cavity of the victim to the point of perforating the mid-torso. In death, the legs droop, the back arches, the arms wing out and downward, and the head reclines backward, as if each victim perished in exultation. Sockets picked clean by the birds stare at the sky. A great hunk of stone stands at the entry to this atrocity, bearing the message, "Here lie Martians all, thralls of the slave king, who thought with wicked delight to take your planet's treasure and break their master's might. All ye who enter here witness their work and despair." The flooded city is their work, and the impalement ours. Is this what the society thinks will inspire the people to return to the fold? Atlas was no monster in the court of my grandmother. He was odd, always rather cold to me, and quick to leave the room when I entered. He despised children. Though he and Aja made Ajax together, their coupling entailed no relationship, from what I understand. In fact, Aja could barely stand the sight of the man. But I cannot believe my father's best friend would be this new monster. Though he was formerly a hostage, my grandmother trusted Atlas without equal. He spurned galas and festivals, and seemed only to stir himself from his library when my grandmother required his unique services. What they were, I never saw until now. I have always held in respect those golds who do not relish their station. Atlas never seemed to. Yet he has let his gorgons loose in ways that demean any claim we have to dignity. So my judgment on him is harsh. I stumble down the line to see the faces of the dead, thinking obscurely that someone should witness them here. all the families they represent, all the strands of life that are linked to theirs. Cruelty will travel down those lines, ensnaring more and more. No one has come to take them down. No footprints have even come within 100 meters. There is a whispering. It comes from a young red man. A sound comes from one of the red bodies, a whispering. He is alive. Barely more than a boy, a faint bit of hair covers his top lip, his cracked lips part, trying to say something more. I give him the remaining water from my pouches. Most of it spills down his chest. He tries to speak again. I edge closer to hear him.
The veil. Send me.
It's then I notice perhaps as many as a dozen still wheeze, their burned skin rising and falling with each insidious breath. I do not care if there are enemies, if impaling is an effective tactic, or even if they deserve this judgment, it is not the jurisdiction of any man to deliver it. I go closer to the boy. My mouth is so dry I barely manage the words. Are you certain? He cannot reply until I spill some of my water into his mouth.
Send me.
There, so close to him, I can see the flecks of copper, brown, and even gold in his red irises. I feel a terrible sadness. I wish I knew that the eyes of his spirit looked upon his veil, that his ancestors were waiting for him in their cool highland valley. But I know it is not so, because I know the veil was created and cultivated by the Board of Quality Control in order to provide an important sociological prerequisite for obedience, a carrot at the end of a hard life. That very same belief that made them able to endure untold hardship in the mines has become a militant faith. He begins to whisper as I draw my razor.
My love, remember the cries when winter died.
He is joined by the others until there is a rasping chorus there upon the pail. The Bellona razor's leather hilt is warm from the sun. Tension travels down my arm as the blade penetrates his chest and then his heart.
Go to your people, I whisper.
He jerks and then is still. More men and women beg for mercy down the line. I move to the next man. He's an older red with a thick beard shot with white and a face like a bulldog's. He begs for mercy, but when I stand in front of him, he and several others begin to laugh. I blink in confusion. Their faces swim in the heat.
Why are they laughing? Burn with us, you golden cunt, he manages,
from a mouth crusted with blood.
Burn with Mars!
Then I understand the trick. I do not move. I look down, knowing what it must be. I push lavender out of the way and blow down into the dirt. A thin mat of pressure-sensitive material lies under the topsoil. If I move my foot, the mine hidden beneath will make me a shower of meat. Even if I dive away, only 2 mines of the hundreds this war employs have a blast radius I'd be able to clear.
I was trying to help you, I say. I was trying to be decent.
The red just laughs, through teeth shattered to the nerve. Without a way to apply equal pressure to my weight on the pad, I dig a small tunnel through the dirt adjacent to the pad to reach the mine. Blindly reaching into the hole, I graze the side casing of the munition. It's a Lotus 13, judging by the octagonal top rim. If I can slide my razor between the pressure pad and the mine, I should be able to sever the hard wire connection. With hands shaking from adrenaline, I toggle the razor's edge to the thinnest setting possible, so the blade is narrow as a piece of paper, a hand's width wide. I slide it sideways down into the hole and trip a countermeasure. Bwee, bwee. Dirt and shredded lavender explode up into my face and blast it upward. I lose my razor. The air rushes out of me as I land hard on my back. Something constricts around me, ensnaring. I push at it, but it cuts my fingers, and the more I push, the more it constricts. A tack net, I realize in relief. Not an explosive. But the relief is short-lived, as I realize my predicament. I lie there in the morning sun, the only shade cast by the poles, the lavender stalks, and the bees. The meters to my razor and water might as well be 1,000. Every time I try to roll or wiggle closer, the net constricts more until it breaks the skin of my scalp. Soon I am immobilized, with blood trickling down my face. For hours I lie there as the sun traces its way across the sky, leaching my body of water as it forms blisters on my exposed skin. I'm the color of a tomato. The lavender sways, the bees buzz, the buzzards chew. I drift in and out of consciousness, woken only when the buzzards engage in a hearty squabble for a choice piece of thigh meat. The red man is dead. They feed on him and watch me. If I could laugh, I would. Heir of Selenius, eaten by birds at the feet of reds, because he tried to be merciful. Lesson learned. It was my guilt for the Vindobona and the helpless people I left for the obsidians that distracted me. I should have known about the mines. I see those victims I abandoned now on the hill, lying in tack nets, watching me with smiles, waiting for me to join them in death. All those lives lost, so I could save Seraphina, who ran to her own slaughter with a smile.
Well, look at this fresh cat. One of the victims says to me. And a blood traitor by the looks of it, says another. He killed some of the bait.
Scar? Heavy desert boots stop in front of me. A child's face bends down from the sky and peers into mine. Something is wrong. It is the color of a dust moth's wings. Oh, it's a mask. Purple works its way into the mask as its wearer crouches near the lavender.
He's missing half his gory damn face. Eyeballs all mush.
A gloved hand twists my head.
No scar. We got ourselves a pixie, lads.
They're gorgons.
Rising? Who else? We don't send unscarred boys to battle. Let's leave him to bubble. This trap's done. Shit to show for it. Stragglers are all herded into Heliopolis for the big hammer.
One of them whistles.
Look at the detailing on his big iron. Skiantus made, bet my life. Slag off. How would you know what a Skiantus blade looks like? You wouldn't even be able to afford the hilt. The Minotaur had one. Treated it like a thirsty lady. Always running his fat mouth about it. See the flower petals? Where? Over the wing. If you say so. What's a pixie doing with a piece like that? If it don't fit, it's howler shit. Search him for trackers, and let's ride. Fear'll sort it.
The child's face looks down at me again as I try to speak.
Time to take a nap, traitor.
The last thing I see is his boot coming down. Chapter 43. Lysander. The Enemy. The Gorgons travel via grav bike. The ride is long and covers several hundred kilometers back the way I walked, back into the damned desert. In the late afternoon, they make a stop in a high desert town surrounding a large mine. I watch, tied to the back of a grav bike, as low-color townsfolk run out to greet the butchers like heroes. Children run along as we trail out of the town, heading toward the snow line of the mountains. Clouds eddy across the darkening sky as the grav bikes slow to go single file along a mountain track. We come to an abrupt halt, boots crunch the snow, and something hits me again on the head. When I regain consciousness, I am cold and wet. The floor is stone. I do not open my eyes yet. My hands are chained above me, bracketed into the wall of a cave. Streams run to either side. Hushed voices converse.
He never asks us any questions, never any. He just takes something away. I told him all I could think of. I just wanted it to stop.
The man sobs. Spare us your weeping, Hadrian. It's bad enough already without you bubbling like a Venusian harlot.
Let him be, Ignatius. We've all told him something, Hadrian. It's prime, brother.
He made time slow down. Something he gave me, I could feel every molecule as he took, as he... The words are lost in the sobs.
How many guards have you counted, Drusilla?
He hoods me every time.
What's it even matter what we've seen? We know he's listening right now. That's the only reason he'd let us stay together. How many howlers has he caught? How many have been retrieved? One, and Orion was so mad she fucked the continent. We're dead, good men. Go with dignity, at least. Soon we'll be upon the pale.
Sure, dignity with a metal pole up your ass. Sounds like a Tuesday for you, Ignatius.
A beat of silence.
The boss will come for us, the leader says.
Faithful to the end, Alex. Your red god is drowned by now, or blasted to bits. The only grace we'll receive is the void.
But that's prime. It's just nothing, after all.
He's not dead.
You really did go full lupus. The whole army is dead, because of the Senate Vox taking our ships, the tiny bastards. Heliopolis will have fallen in the siege, and the army will have been trapped in the desert under the guns of the Ash Armada. They're probably already nailing Darrow to the bow of the Anihilo to sail on Luna.
Then why are we still in a cave?
There are at least five around me, all of them golds. Martian accents, mostly. Elysian, with a faint flavour of the Jovian moons. I listen a little longer. Europan dialect. Howlers, Darrow, Alex, the accents. It leaves little left to guess. There are two others sleeping. How many more I can't tell because of the sound of the stream. I would guess nine.
Scarface is awake and listening to us, the one called Ignatius says.
Are you awake, my good man? Another asks with more authority. The leader, his accent would be near cultured, but for how he mumbles.
Don't be afraid. We're all fucked here. Eyes open or closed, doesn't much matter.
He laughs with thin confidence. I make a show of opening my right eye. There are 10 other prisoners chained as I am against the wall. 2 are sleeping. 2 gorgons sit about 30 meters off in the throat of a tunnel. That is the room's only exit.
Told you he was awake, Ignatius says.
He's a huge, handsome brute.
I don't see a scar, the woman says, Drusilla.
Like they weren't wise to that after year one, Ignatius says.
What's your name?
Drusilla asks. Her face is darker than the rest. Kind eyes watch me from swollen eyelids.
Easy now, my good man, Alexander says. You've been mauled rather gruesomely.
Even with both his ears missing and half his face grotesquely swollen, I can tell he is around my own age, and that he used to be a handsome man.
Staggeringly, I wager.
His shoulders are incredibly broad for his frame. Legs, meant to eat kilometres, are folded under him. The last time I saw him was in a hollow Cassius and I watched on the Archie as he stood behind Darrow during a speech. Alexander our Arcos, Lorne's grandson, my estranged cousin, and Kalindora's nephew on his mother's side.
"What's your name?" he asks. "Take your time. Concussions befuddle the best of us."
I heed Octavia's ministrations and fall back on an identity with long-term upside, which I can defend, and they will be unable to verify. Can't be rising, can't be society. I have no scar on my face, and can properly emulate the Mercurian dialect popular in what counts as high society in Erebos. The identity is natural, and a little hilarious, but I'm half mad from dehydration, so I dive in.
Cato au Vitruvius, I say.
The identity I used for security reasons when I would visit Glerastes for studies. It belongs to a fictional son of a real local family of high history and middling future.
Salve, Cato. I'm Alexander, Drusilla, Ignatius, Crastus, Hadrian.
In turn, he nods at the kind-eyed woman, the giant, a pretty man in his 30s, at a squat bull of a gold male. "The Knights of Elysium, at your service, such as we are."
"Oh, now you're a Knight of Elysium," Drusilla mutters.
"Arcosian Knights," one corrects. "Who are you?" Ignatius demands of me. "He means, how did you end up in this hell?" Alexander asks. He smiles crimson. Not one of his teeth remains. I'm surprised by the kindness of him, considering. He looked haughtier on camera, and Grandmother's Securitas file said he was incredibly arrogant, intelligent, if not too creative, with a paternal deficit complex after the death of his father. His defensiveness of the Reaper suggests the complex's newest placeholder. I tell them a nervous story of the dam breaking at Erebos. Ordnance falling on the city accounts for my burns, trying to rescue survivors for the sunburns, and trying to take the impaled victims down for the tacnet wounds. Drusilla asks me sly trick questions about my home, suggesting she's been to Erebos. But so have I, and I trapped it all in amber. I can still see the silk market and the bright belts of the citizens and the gold filigree in every single street sign. I pass their meagre tests.
"You have been here a while, haven't you?" I ask.
"Yut," Alex replies with another trap. "Pardon?" I ask, flummoxed.
"You're not a soldier, are you?"
Alexander says. Another assumption trap. I don't understand.
"Never mind.
I hardly know a single mate who's enough money to pull the Institute," I reply. "My parents were silk merchants, and not grand ones by any judge."
"Then what did you do?" Drusilla asks.
"Drank, mostly," I reply. "My father bribed the magistrate to let me stay in Erebos after the conscription, as a civil engineer magistrate. War is such a ghastly affair." I give a little shudder.
"So he's a duty-dodging pixie." "I'm not swallowing this snake shit," Ignatius says. "He's a plant, or at the very least a slaver by participation." "So's every person on Mercury, according to you. They all act like it. Only thing you get out of hugging a Mercurian is a knife in the back. They're all swindlers and drunks, the sun-dark lot of 'em."
"I'm darker than him," Drusilla says.
"Semantics. Will you two hens stop pecking?"
Alexander snaps.
"Why do you want to know how long we've been here, Cato?"
"It's just that Heliopolis hasn't fallen," I say.
"You said it must have."
Even Ignatius listens intently.
"I heard from a man who'd been in the Ladan that Darrow led his army across the desert under the cover of the storm. He hit Ajax Algrimus as he was besieging the city."
"That madness worked?"
Alexander asks. He grins hideously with empty gums at Ignatius.
"I told you, the boss has everything under control."
Or he's lost control completely.
Chapter 44. Ephraim. Hunt of the Last Light. Xenophon leads me into the Skoogie hangar with a bored expression on that wan face. "Gods, is quiet," I mutter. Not in the city below, where construction crews work night and day to bring Olympia to its former glory, or in the lands around, which vibrate with the sound of obsidian flocking to the Volkland, or on the coasts, where all-tribe rip-wings eye Republic fighters across the thermic, or in the mines, where reds and oranges hijack Quicksilver's robots to continue helium operations. It is quiet in Eagle Rest, and only Eagle Rest, because Sephi and Valdir have taken the children to hunt. My Skoogie are off on missions, and I'm left, like an old man, to rattle around an abandoned house. "Walk faster, please. We mustn't be late to the kill," the Logos says. "Maybe we should be heading to the landing pads then, genius." "We are, in a way." We turn the corner and I stop, dead in my tracks. One of the most beautiful ships I've ever seen sits beside ugly, scoogy tactical ships, like a 2-comma pink in a frontline brothel. She's 60 meters long, sleek-hulled, equipped with twin ion engines, 2 railguns, sensor-resistant hull, and is shaped like a sideways hammerhead shark. She's painted jade green. Apollo's cock, that's a beauty. A gift from Her Majesty, Xenophon says, handing me the slim Omnicard. Nah, it is in your contract, a top-tier flyer. It was collected from Quicksilver's mansion in Nike. I dare say you'll get more use out of it than he will. I put in the contract because I thought I'd need an escape route out of here. I never expected to actually get it, just when I'm thinking I may not need it. Still, I snatch the Omnicard and practically levitate toward the ship. She's not just a racer, she's a deep space tigress. Could probably run from Mars to the Sun in 2 weeks flat. Well, maybe not that fast. Keep in mind, tracking measures have been installed, and the children aren't allowed within a kilometer of it. I run my hand over the hull. What's the catch? Xenophon smiles as a gaggle of dignitaries comes around the corner. I fear her maiden voyage will be as a taxi. What will you call her? I turn back to grin at the white. Snowball. It's green. Still a snowball. As the South Pole slumps toward the gloom of winter, a wind the obsidians call Breath of the Underdark moans through the glacial valley. This slow, incessant current will freeze the eyelashes off a man and blacken the skin in 20 minutes. It signals the beginning of darkness for the pole. From the warm confines of my thermal gear, 2/3 the way up a young mountain, all I feel is a gentle tug of nature telling me I don't belong. I look around, and the crouched braes behind me give a nod and murmur. Kalt, Granir! Nier, Granir! Kan, niek, kalt! Another says. Fair, Ronje, ver, en la! I dust snow off my shoulder. Cold. Grey fox? Nah. Grey fox can't get cold. God fire burns inside him. I'm a walking, talking totem of invulnerability, a spirit warrior, proof of the existence of gods. Only Osgard knows I was under major psychotropic influence during the mine heist. The obsidians either don't know or don't care that the hunter-killers didn't fire on me because I had grey DNA and held a mop. I wasn't touched by the gods. I just wasn't a threat, according to their software. All they know is that when Sefi and Valdir caught up, I stood amongst the enemy howling like an ice-veined banshee. Sefi and Valdir hit like the hammer of God 5 seconds after I landed. Can't rid myself of the sight of armored obsidians hacking at tripod robots, or how their meat smelled as the robot lasers cleaved through 5 braves at a time. 35,000 obsidian crack troops died, cleaning out the hunter-killers in the mines of Cimmeria. And me? Not a bloody scratch. Osgard got me drunk for 3 solid days. Pax stood in amused silence when he saw me being carried on the shoulders of Valkyrie. Electra literally almost died laughing when I told them what's what afterwards in my rooms in Olympia. I thought she'd be jealous, but she thinks it's the funniest thing she's ever bloody heard, though the mop jokes are rather overdue. Now she actually talks to me without looking like she wants to cut my balls off. That's all it took. Freyhild and the Skoogie are drunk with valor for their part in taking the mines. Several of the females have even been given the honor of taking part in the hunt. The men stand on the ledge with me, Valdir and the highest-ranking male Jarls, tribal leaders. They were no less brave in battle, and they know it. It's always been this way, but that doesn't mean they like it. Sefi and Pax peer off a ledge not 20 meters away, amongst a long pack of Valkyrie hunters. The furs they wear are crusted in a shell of ice from days of tracking. It crackles when they move and twinkles when light from the shoulder lamps of the mechanized guards catches in the gloom. For 6 days, the Valkyrie have stalked their prey, while Electra accompanied Freyhild on the stalking expedition to the White Shards, Pax accompanied Sephi to find scale trace at the sundered peaks. The know-it-all could tell you the molecular structure of obsidian arrowheads, but couldn't have cared less the day of their departure. The boy misses his mother. Apparently, Sephi knows something about children. It's difficult to hold on to grief after 6 days of whiteout conditions, frostbite, saddle sores, and sleeping in seal-hide lean-tos. Pax knows how lucky he is to sit in the saddle behind her. Of the obsidian braves, not even Valdir ever has mounted a griffin for a hunt. Pax's melancholy has been replaced by intense focus. His head snaps back when a high-pitched whistle echoes across the glacial valley, several notes higher than the screaming wind. Xenophon, wrapped to his nose in thermal gear, explains to the political guests I ferried on the snowball, Valdir is in motion. The chasers are out. The beast is flushed from its alpine cavern. The Killwing waits. Sephi waits. The snow settles on her shoulders and bone helmet. She looks like a god of winter, a permanent and unyielding feature of the mountain. A second whistle trills. The younger Valkyrie look to her in expectation. The older hunters know the queen's patience and stay motionless. The guests murmur in excitement. A third whistle sounds, impatient, urging her forward. Sephi resists. Pax shoots her a glance. Seconds tick past. And then Sephi raises a clenched fist. Sleer, she whispers, jumping off the ledge. A horn moans. Sleer, 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 shout the Valkyrie, and 50 women slip over the edge. Pax goes with. Hunt, Xenophon parrots. The Valkyrie disappear, and a moment later a series of screams rises from the other side of the ridge. Sephi's pale steed bursts off the ledge beneath. Pax rides in the archer's saddle behind her, not out of place or afraid like I thought he'd be. A rush of air forces snow into my mouth as several griffin banking overhead dislodge snowdrifts above. Two red allies stumble into each other, laughing and marveling at the mounted Valkyrie careening down into the valley keening death. Bare-armed in the cold, Valdir steps forward and watches with a practiced eye and a purity of awe, love, and jealousy. Anyone could see how much he wishes to fly upon the beasts of his people. I don't like the man. He's a closed book, but I feel for him. No longer a slave of Grimace, but still not quite free. Your first hunt? Xenophon asks me, taking a pause from the narration so the onlookers can collect themselves. I nod. Not yours, it seems. My third. During the war, Her Majesty would return when she could to honor the Sun Death. I believe she feared she would forget who she was if she spent too long away from the ice. I advised her against this hunt, however. Osgard and Valdir seemed bullish enough. They would. It may invigorate the spirit of the shaman and satisfy Valdir's expectations of a queen. But such considerations are specious for a modern head of state, given the unnecessary exposure to risk. Not to mention the details of state which pile up in her absence. I designed her government to function with a monarch. Without one, it functions at 50% efficiency. Not that Valdir or the madman would care for such trivialities. Xenophon looks around. Have you seen the madman? He's probably drunk in a cargo hold somewhere, I say, growing annoyed. I want to watch the hunt. It is a high probability. The sexless mammal squints to the west as Valdir points and calls out to the others. Ah, the drake. Excuse me. I look west. Scales glint in the gloom, rippling low against the snowy boulders of the valley floor. The glint becomes a blur that becomes a leviathan of the ice. Though I know its ancestors were carved by mad violets in conjunction with yellow geneticists, the ice drake seems an ancient creature, something older than we are. I realize I've forgotten to breathe. This specimen is a black ice drake of the Nidhagga strain, one of the rarest and most revered creatures in Obsidian mythology, Xenophon explains to the guests. He who strikes with malice is said to be the bringer of winter. This one is an old bull, as can be divined by the 9 lateral tusks and triple horn, which mark his decades. Of course, the hunting of sows is forbidden and punishable by the blood eagle. The guests whisper with awe, as if the creature were magical and not 30 tons of lab-engineered death. Pursued by Valdir and her chasers, the bull tears through the mountain valley. Even at our distance, I feel a chill. The obsidian guards watch in appreciation, Valdir in pure love. Few would have ever seen a drake in flight, or slipped into a lair to kill and drink the blood of a hatchling to begin the way of stains. The drake spots Sephi's hunting band ahead and banks right, thinking to escape over the north side of the valley. Thunder crackles from the peaks. Obsidian youths, who summited the mountains with hooks and rope, light sulfur-based charges into their braziers and launch them into the clouds with slings. Huge claps of sound frighten the dragon back and forth across the valley as it seeks some escape, only to be herded again and again by small explosions from surrounding peaks. Someone screams as it banks our way. Amidst the guards, Skugi light fuses on the brazier and hurl the clay bombs into the air. They laugh as the pots explode. Goodkind tosses me too. I light them and hurl them skyward. Boom! Boom! The rush of air from the drake's wings nearly knocks me off my feet. It passes a stone's throw from us. Debris and rocks the size of a man's head are crusted in the ice along the worm's belly. Attendants scatter, laughing in relief as it pinballs back down into the alley toward the queen. Valdir rushes to the cliff's edge to lean forward and watch. Scores follow him. Above a frozen alpine lake, an inverted V of Valkyrie hunters forms around the drake. Sephi waits at the far tip of the V to deliver the killing stroke. But as the first arrows from the obsidians fly from their flanks, the drake uses an updraft to go into precarious climb. It knocks 2 griffins from the air. Their riders flail from the saddles, but their safety ropes snap them back toward their tumbling steeds. One recovers. The other collides with a mountainside below as her griffin is bisected by the razor tips of the drake's wings. The guests are horrified. Valdir touches his heart. A good death. His eyes search the chasers, young griffin riders with more spirit than experience looking for Freyhild, I reckon. My optics pick her up by the green plumes of her headdress. Electra sits in the archer saddle behind her, priming combustible arrows. Sephi blows a horn, and the griffin V inverts as the riders kick their griffins into motion. The beasts bank upside down and race beneath the drake as Freyhild leads the chasers to follow it to the higher altitude. Huge sounds rattle the valley as they shoot arrows with combustible tips to herd it back down. The sound scares the dragon off its ascent, forcing it back towards Sephi's reformed V near the ground. The first of Sephi's hunters begin to harry the drake, soaring past to hurl spears or shoot arrows into its side. Only Sephi continues flying away from it, pushing her griffin 200 meters past the rest before she banks back around. Her wing sisters pull taut ropes connected to the spears and arrows embedded in the creases of the dragon's scales. The first riders are jerked sideways by its mass. But soon, more than 20 ropes are secured, and together the sky hunters anchor the drake along its path toward their queen. The weakest scale is just beneath the dragon's eyes, Xenophon explains as I switch to long-range optics. A difficult shot for even the most skilled archer. Sky hunters aid their daughters in crafting their first bow from god tree wood and the gut string of leopard seals. Only when the daughters are strong enough to draw this bow do they begin to practice marksmanship. Two more bows will they make before they fashion their sky bow from the horn of a Tangrisnir goat. In her time, Sefi killed 6 ice drakes with her bow, named in honor of her father, Promise of Pale Horse. The same bow which slew 2 gold overlords of this province on the day of breaking. Harnessed from the sides, the dragon continues its course towards Sefi, not yet noticing her. 200 meters, 100, Pax hands her the sky bow from her saddle. It is twice as long as a man. She knocks a great arrow. The drake will be slowing from the marrow fish venom in its veins, Xenophon says. But the drake seems, if anything, even angrier. Sefi stands in her stirrups. The drake is at 80 meters. She draws back on the bow. And then, nothing. She seems to freeze. I zoom in with my hood's optics. She draws back on the string again and again stops halfway, unable to summon enough strength to draw the arrow back to her face, much less her ear. Xenophon has gone silent. Valdir stands. Something is wrong. The drake is 50 meters out and sees only Sefi and Pax blocking his escape atop God-Eater. Sefi's given up trying to shoot and veers her God-Eater swiftly down and to the left. The drake follows, lashing out with its wings and severing half the ropes while hurling other sky hunters, including Freyhild, through the air. Electra nearly falls from the saddle. Something's gone terribly wrong. The drake closes on Pax and Sefi, extending its neck to impossible length. Its teeth snap off the back of their saddle, almost tearing Pax in half. God-Eater slashes futilely against the hard scales. The drake coils its neck for another lunge when Freyhild slashes past and buries a spear in its eye, just missing the sweet spot. She hurls herself from her griffin and lands on the dragon's head, burying 2 climbing hooks. She's tossed sideways, almost losing her perch. The drake ignores her and bears down again on Sefi and Pax, trapping them against the valley's side. God-Eater scrambles along the sheer walls, unable to escape. I act without thinking. I rush to a stupefied brave and demand his rifle. "The creed forbids it," a guard growls. "Fuck your creed," I jerk at the rifle, but in his hardened grip it goes nowhere. "Give him the rifle," Valdir orders from behind. Grudgingly, the guard surrenders it. Praying I've not run out of time, I rush past the gawking onlookers and fall prone, steadying the barrel on a divot in the rocks. Its energy pack whines as it charges up. The targeting computer is slow to start. I go analog. Thanks to the guard's delay, I've lost time. The lights from the nearby shuttles reflect against the optic. They disappear. I glance sideways to see Valdir blocking them for me with his body, not his first time as a spotter. For a moment, I think he won't let me take the shot. I could hit Freyhild, but he nods. "Wait for it to turn its head." I peer back into the optic. God-Eater has gone to ground, trapped by the drake on a rocky scree, as the other Valkyrie fruitlessly try to regroup and bypass its razor wings. Only Freyhild protects her queen, stabbing in vain at the thick scales of the drake's head, but her efforts dirty my shot. I sink into my breathing and try to forget Valdir looming over my shoulder as I settle the crosshairs on Freyhild's back. The dragon's head is faced away. She blocks the shot. "Move! Move!" My hands shake from nerves. Her arms raised to plunge the spear into the back of the dragon's neck. I wait for it to sink deep. It bites into the meat behind the ear slits, The drake whirs its face around, snapping at her. I aim two hands above her shoulder and squeeze. A beam of white light divides the gloom. A city forms around the downed drake on the frozen plain. It is called a Drekenhauger, a dragon mound. Tribeswomen and men of the Valkyrie spires, along with a great many of their allied tribes, bring huge logs for the bonfire on sleds pulled by aurochs. Lesser shamans ferry vats of hard grog, berry liquor called azag, and sweet mead in leather gourds the size of bathtubs. Chanting and drums resound from a train of thousands as they flow into the valley to witness the last harvest of light. They chant Freyhild's name and mine, protectors of the queen. The young Skugi sways over to where I stand with Pax and Xenophon in a great bear cloak and wraps me in a hug. They sing of us, Grania. They sing of the glory of our arms. No sound is sweeter. Here I thought they'd pin me to a rock and splay open my ribs, I say to Freyhild. A poacher's gun is not a poacher's harp, she says, then draws close. But I would have killed it on my own. She sees me eye the cooked skin of her right shoulder. Close shot, she saunters away, laughing and shouting encouragement to the harvesters. Did you know you would hit it? Xenophon asks. I knew I had a chance. The white considers that. And if you had killed her while Valdir stood over your shoulder? I doubt we'd be having this conversation. True enough. Now I believe I've had enough excitement for the day. I must return to my functions. See you at the party. First drinks on me. I am not invited. The white looks me up and down. Your assimilation isn't surprising. You display traits any martial culture would value. I, on the other hand, will always be an alien. Enjoy the sun death. I am told its color composition can be quite moving to the warrior spirit. The white sways away toward a flyer to be taken back to the Echo of Ragnar, which Sephi disappeared inside as soon as it set down on a mesa overlooking the valley. The destroyer, more a mobile city of war than a ship, makes even the mountains look small. That's one sad human, I say to Pax. They're not sad, Pax murmurs, more focused on the harvesting than our blathering. If anything, they're sad that they're not sad. I soon forget about Xenophon. The harvest is a sight. Young braves climb the dragon's flank, wedging climbing hooks between the slippery scales to carve the most flavorful meat from the sides of the spine. Electra races several obsidian youths up the side and has them beat by 10 meters when a dead scale sheaves off and she plummets back down the flank, hits the elbow of a dragon's broken wing, ricochets and plunges into a gaping incision made by harvesters. When she emerges covered with gore, the obsidians whoop with laughter. Poised on the ridge of the dragon's back, the crews use levers to dislodge the scales and long saws to butterfly the spine. Great hunks of meat are stacked in steaming piles atop a parade of sledges, brought in ceremonial fashion by youths as the elders drink and call capricious instructions. Pax whispers the destiny of each body part to me. The scales are for ceremonial rites and griffin battle armor, the joint fluid and eyes for poultices and elixirs, the blubber for candles and lamps, and to be mixed with berries to make a dish called artukai, the liver and brain to be eaten frozen or raw. Obviously, cooking would destroy the vitamin C. Obviously. I poke his hip. You're not wearing your harness. We were hunting. I slap his head. I told you to always wear your harness. The harness he made himself in his garage. After all, I got a ship now. Which? He asks. The jade one. He whistles. Too good for you. A group of sky hunters with pierced noses and tattered ears stomp over to me to give a sign of respect. The women look at Pax and cover their eyes in shame. He pretends not to care as he examines my ship in the distance. Looks like you're the foreman, I say. Naturally. What happened up there? Why could Seffi not draw her bow? He focuses on the harvesting, pretending to not notice the scornful looks passing braves give him. The cord has an immensely strong molecular composition, but can contract if not protected from the cold. I forgot to keep it in its heat sheath during the stalk. Is that true? He makes no expression. Of course. I am a heatlander and a man. It was expected I would draw the gods' ire by joining the sacred hunt. I forgot my duties to my wing leader. When was the last time you forgot anything? He looks over with a chiding expression. Sometimes it's better to let a wheel squeak than break the cart trying to fix it. The truth sits unspoken between us. Either the bowstring was tampered with, which seems an awkward way to assassinate Seffi, or something is wrong with Seffi herself. But how wrong? Oh, shit! What is that? I cry as harvesters pull two brain-sized gelatinous sacks from the drake's belly. The testicles, of course. They have intense hallucinogenic properties when dried and ground down. Berserkers use them to summon the winter rage. Now they are forbidden, per Seffi's decree. I wince as the testicles are tossed onto a fire by a shaman. No wonder the men never speak up around here. At a jingle behind us, Pax's face lights up. Lo, Osgard, he calls, as the shaman arrives on a sleigh pulled by two blue-painted aurochs, each with tiny bells hanging from their great ivory horns. The shaman drinks from a hollow tusk and jumps down from a bed of furs to greet us.
Stupid heatlander,
he snaps at Pax, striking at him with his riding crop.
Everyone talks, brave to pup. You forgot Stringard. You embarrass me. You embarrass all men. You nearly killed our queen.
He gesticulates drunkenly.
They think I am stupid. Teach you nothing.
He tosses Pax a hooked blade as long as Pax's leg.
Do not sit back in shame. Go, harvest, unless you forgot my instructions. I need 2 kilos liver, 10 kilos lung, 1 kilo spleen, 2 ounce flame ichor, and 4 gonad veins. Do not embarrass me again, stupid boy.
Without objecting, Pax departs at a jog. Good little soldier. Bit late, I say to Osgard.
Should have used boots or ship.
Osgard sighs and punches his most muscled aurochs on the flank.
Preparing for my godspeak in ruins of spires. Nethelfiar sensed evil spirits within a crag. Became frightened. I gave him grog. And he found his courage.
The aurochs sways back and forth drunker than his shaman. Osgard squints at Pax joining the harvesters, who make a show of excluding him.
It is sacrilege to kill a high beast with a firearm, Osgard says. Valkyrie nailed 2 poachers to a rock and had a buzzard eat their liver for just that 2 weeks past.
I've been told, I say, as another group of sky hunters come to pay their respects to me. What's wrong with Seffi? I ask as they depart. He doesn't hear me.
What was the alien doing during this?
What is it with you two? I mutter. Xenophon didn't cast a spell. And you know as well as I do that Pax can draw Olympia by memory from a single glance. Kid didn't forget to warm a stupid string. So what's wrong with Seffi? He pours himself more grog and pretends not to have heard me.
When the sun dies tonight, I go to read the fire bones.
It is custom for the Drake Slayers to bear the bones. I expect you will observe this custom at least.
That night, in the small city that has grown about the remains of the dragon, the children of the Spires, last of Ragnar's people, throw one hell of a party for the dying sun. They light a great bonfire of dragon fat and mountain pine. In the flames, great hunks of flesh are roasted on long skewers and served with wild tubers, mountain berries, oysters, and great horns of grog passed out by a stout obsidian man with no nose. Freyhild and I are given fresh necklaces of dragon's teeth to mark us as the Drake Slayers. Mine is given with a degree of comedy and grumbling from Valdir's conservative cohort, but not Valdir himself. As the obsidians feast and laugh, Osgard leads a troop of braves wearing masks made from the bones of sacred tribal creatures. They pretend they are ice sprites, dropping little diamonds in cups or tucking thin bars of gold behind ears. The warriors wheel about, trying to catch the sprites, only to snag empty air and roar with laughter. If they are caught, the sprites must drink until their captor is satisfied. I catch three, including poor Gudkind, and send them reeling from grog to pass out by the fire. Sprawled on furs, Electra listens to obsidian veterans tell stories about their days with the goblin. Pax bickers back and forth in Nagal with one of Sefi's war chiefs about the strategic necessity of his father using the storm gods on Mercury. I sit in comfort, warmed by the fire, light-headed from the grog, and satiated by the meat from the hunt. I've not felt this tranquil in years. There is a joy here, a sense of eternal family, with no worry of the world that seeks to destroy them. They are home and free. Is this what it is like to be them? Mars is not what I expected, neither Olympia nor the ice. It is simpler here, sure, but my mind is quieter without the peripheral madness of Hyperion. There, the current demands you to do something to define your own essence, to rise above the human rivers in the street, or be drowned under them. Here, you can simply be. I wish I could give this to Volga. Poor girl has always feared her own people. What would they think of her birth? But maybe she would find this to be the home she was always looking for. Hell, part of me wishes Lyria could feel this again, what with her family all gone. I mean, such damn good spirits that I wish even Xenophon could share the feast. The poor creature is always standing to the side, never included, unless Sefi needs information or a task fulfilled. Not that Xenophon seems to mind. This warm peace is an illusion, I know. My time in it is fleeting. It won't last. Not the night, not the celebration, not the hunt, not my friendship with the obsidians, not Cimmeria's acceptance of obsidian rule. They give them jobs, a percentage of the mine profits, chase the Red Hand north, but more and more obsidians flock to Mars by the day. How long till the Reds resent them? Or Aegea feels the power balance shift. In the morning, the echo of Ragnar will absorb us and lift off. Then back to Olympia we go, Sefi to her government, Valdir to his hunt of the Red Hand, the children to their lessons and grim future. Me to being me. Part of me wonders if I can't stay in this moment, find a place in Olympia with these people who have welcomed me. They have a dark spirit in their nature, sure, we all do. At least here seems a leader intent on finding their better virtues. I play with the dragon's teeth and watch Sefi across the fire for some sign of ailment. There are none, except the long glove she always wears. She pulls it up as she watches Freyhild hold court from behind her chalice of wine. Sefi's eyes wander to her mate. Valdir is drunk and worse than ever at hiding his lust for Freyhild. is so obvious why the big man watches her. While Seffi is by nature reserved and seems aged prematurely from the weight of her crown, Freyhild brims from life. She fends off long-haired suitors with a stick, swatting them towards the fire, before twirling around to lead the braves in song. Seffi is the past, the present, but more and more, it seems Freyhild is the future. Dizzy from ale, I use Pax's head to help me stand, and excuse myself to take a piss. I wander away from the fires to where their warm light licks at the darkness beyond. It's so cold, I pull up my hood and watch through the thermal vision as my piss carves runes in the snow. I hear the jingle of metal behind me and pull off my hood. Valdir unbuckles the huge ruby clasp of his belt. I step back in surprise.
"Do not fear," the big man rumbles. "I am not here to rape you."
That is a very odd thing to say. He drops his pants. Oh. His huge thighs are moon pale in the gloom, as thick as tree trunks. As he squats to shit, long muscles ripple beneath tattooed skin, notched and striated from old wounds. Drunk, he drinks more from a huge horn and nods to my hood.
"Does thermal vision make it look bigger?"
"It's not the bark that counts, old boy, it's the bite. I'll leave you to your defecation."
"What is horn for?"
"Surname of the seed donor."
"Your father?"
The earthy scent of his shit wafts over to me, more or less.
"Was he a great man?"